once he's going to give me a chance to switch over. I want to ask the guy a question, and then I can help him because I'm great at interfacing. You have 13 votes. What do you want to do? You want to source or do you want to sink? Explain to me what you're trying to do. Are you pulling 13 volts down? Are you pulling a device to ground? Or are you sourcing voltage? That's the first thing we need to know.
You got it, Glenn.
I'm sinking it down from the rail.
So he's taking 13.8 volts and supplying it to a load by way of this control device. Over to you, Howie.
Hi, If he wants to give a device, if he wants to be, you want to supply 13 volts to a device. You want to turn it on. So one side of the device is getting 13 volts. The other side of the device is at ground potential. Is that correct? So you want to supply 13 volts, and you want to have this be turned on and off by a TTL signal. Is that correct?
Yes, that's exactly it.
He said, yes, that's exactly it. So what device would you suggest that's already built, ready for T2L logic, that's going to turn on a solid-state relay function? I guarantee they already exist out there. Over to you, Howie.
Oh, I would use something like a 40, like a CMOS switch, like a 4066. One of those devices, they have those available. They have those available that are bidirectional. Or you can use something like an opto device. You can use something like a TIL-111, something along those lines. You can use a TIL, an opto device, or you can use a TLL to a CMOS switch. They got something like a 4066 along those lines, Dick.
So, Howie, if I look up the data sheet for a 4066 chip, which probably has been around for 10 years, I think you're telling me it'll probably tell me everything I need to know, and that's something that's got a lot of history, and it's probably not very expensive. That's my bunch of guesses. WB2HWW, K2RIW.
Oh, that's been around since the 80s. Been around forever. They're actually used for audio, but they can be used for, DC. They also need a supply voltage. So, yeah, you can do that. They have an input, a gate voltage, and that's it. I would use something like an opto device. An opto relay device or something along those lines, in which you have an LED as the input, as the emitter, and that goes to, let's say, an opto device. So to turn on the LED, all I need to do is come out of my TTL device with a current limiting resistor, something like 470 ohms, whatever it is. Back to you, Dick.
As you can tell, Glenn, when you start searching for solid-state relay equivalent, you start Googling those words, I think you're going to find at least 10 devices out there that do exactly what you want, and your choice is to choose the one that's got the right size, the right T2L input command, the right voltage tolerance, the right current, and the right price. And my gut feel is you're going to get this for well under $5 and solve your problem. And when you do that search, let us know what you find, Glenn. N2ZEA for any other final, K2LIW in the tech net.
Okay, that's great. You guys helped out a lot. I'm using an opto isolator from the TTL to begin with, and the isolator turns the Darlington on, but it just doesn't get high enough to do what I need to do. So I'll switch out the Darlington for something like a solid-state relay and see if that works. Thank you for the help. Appreciate it.
Question. You're using, let me ask you a question here, WB2HWW, and you can get these devices for nothing. You're coming from a TTL point. What is the device that you're trying to turn on? Let us know what kind of device it is. That's the first thing. Back to you.
What I'm trying to do is control the functions on an audio generator chip, and I need to go all the way up to the rail to control the chip to turn it on and off without distorting the sine wave. So I was hoping the Darlington would do it, but it doesn't.
So he wants to fall as close to 13.8 volts that he's got. He wants that to go to his device that's going to be the load. So he's trying to have minimum dropout, so to speak. Howie, W2HWW, K2IW.
All right, so what he needs to do is this. Now, wait a minute. What he could do is this. Take an NPN transistor, okay? Put the collector at 13.8 volts. Take the emitter of the transistor and put that to the supply of the IC. That's one way to do it. You take the emitter... You take the emitter of the transistor. You tie the emitter to the voltage to the VCC of the chip that you want to turn on and off. You tie the collector to VCC, and then you just supply a base voltage. That's all you need. A volt or two should be able to do this. I would not use a Darlington, because a Darlington is going to give you like 1.2 volts drop. So what I would do is I would use something like an NPN transistor. And if you only need 10 or 20 milliamperes, any type of transistor might work. And if you really don't want to have a big voltage drop, you might want to use a Schottky transistor or a germanium. But I think a silicon would work, something like a 2N2222, because you don't have a lot of current there, so you're not going to have a lot of power dissipation. So you don't need a Darlington, because if you're just turning on and off an audio chip and you need 6 to 8 milliamperes, then that's what I would do. The emitter goes to the chip, the collector goes to the supply voltage.
And when it's done,
that exact thing, except the chip doesn't come on. The audio signal, the sine wave is not pure when it first starts up, and it's greatly distorted and it won't work. I need to get the sine wave to start from zero crossing. So there's a way to control the chip, but the control voltage has to be right up at the rail.
I guarantee there are solid state relays that'll do this for you with only 1 or 2 tenths of a volt drop. Because it's really a saturated transistor into the solid-state relay that's doing the work. And some transistors, when saturated, only have 2 or 3 tenths of a volt drop. So if you have 2 or 3 tenths of a volt drop from your 13.8, my guess is your audio circuit would give you full performance. Is that true, Glenn? Over you, Glenn, K2LAW.
What's the chip he's trying to control?
An ICO, I think it's an 8038, it's audio, it's a function generator chip. It'll do sine wave, square wave, and triangle wave.
Are you trying to turn the power on and off of the chip? Is that what I'm hearing?
I tried that, but you don't get a good clean on and off. So there's a place on the chip where you can control the sine wave, and you can get it to start at zero crossing, so you get a nice pure wave. I need a tone burst.
Yeah, what's the actual model number of the chip? And let me look it up, because it sounds like you're chasing your tail for something that should be very simple.
Okay, hold on, it's in the garage. Give me one sec.
Anyway, Dick, you wanted to know where the closest channel 12 is currently? It's in Ohio.
So since that's so darn far away, in theory, you could move to channel 12 anytime you want to, couldn't you, Eric?
Yeah, for some reason my computer locked up here. No, there's one in Pennsylvania also.
Okay, I'm back. It's an ICL 8038, and if you take the capacitor, which is on, I believe, pin 10, and you bring it all the way up to the rail, then the chip will cease functioning. And that works out great.
Hang on a second while I look it up.
So when you take that lead that was up to the rail and bring it back down, I think you're saying you get a very good zero crossing of that tone burst?
Oh, yeah, the spec sheet says that's the preferred method to get do zero crossing, get the sine wave to come out for the tone burst.
Let me ask you again. It's ICL, is India Charlie Lima 8028?
0038.
Got it, okay. I think we should start the space report. Sorry, we're just so late. And then as soon as Eric takes his time and finds that information, he'll come back to us. WS2N, K2RIW, a poll. What has NASA been doing this week? What are they about to do? You've got a poll.
Okay, this is WS2N. Yeah, the main story started actually the day after the last net. SpaceX had two people approach him and offer millions and millions of dollars to take a ride on a crewed Dragon around the moon. Elon Musk made an announcement saying that he's already got a deposit for two private citizens. They're not astronauts. They're not from NASA. They're going to get into their Dragon spacecraft in 2018, the end of 2018, and blast off from Launch Complex 39A and go on an 8-day trip, figure eight around the moon, and come on back. So that was the main story I wanted to talk about, because NASA now is thinking about doing a similar type of thing.
I think
before the announcement of SpaceX, NASA is now considering their first launch vehicle when it's complete, the SLS space launch system that the building will eventually go on to Mars and to different planets. This vehicle is supposed to be first flown in 2018, again toward the end of 2018. And it was originally planned to be unmanned, and then a couple of years later they were going to man it, and they would have started the manned space program again, for NASA. But originally it was going to be unmanned, and now they're thinking about let's man it, let's put two people on it, capability of carrying four. But let's put two people on it, and they were planning on having a flight around the moon, except they were thinking about actually orbiting the moon and then coming back. So, these two things, this possibility is out there. And again, I think Elon Musk, of course, he's always a little optimistic. Many things he says, does come true, but sometimes, years down the road. That's the present thinking now. Having two flights to actually go around the moon, one by NASA and one by SpaceX.
I seem to remember Apollo 8, roughly 1968, had three astronauts that went into lunar orbit on Christmas Eve and read a chapter of Genesis and then came back. So here we are 50-some-odd years downrange, repeating that to some degree. And if they just do a simple figure-eight loop and come back, that's the minimum risk. From Elon Musk's point of view, it's a kind of a win-win. He gets a chance to advance his hardware. He gets a lot of publicity. I guarantee the money these people are paying are not going to really pay for the trip, so to speak. But so these two very rich guys are going to fly around the moon, and I guess they're the first people since NASA that have decided to do this. The first, civilians. The first civilians to get into the lunar area. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I have two questions for the gentleman. One is, is he using a split supply? And if not, I need to know that. And the other thing is, how is he intending to turn the output on and off? What's the methodology he's using?
You've got it, Glenn.
Okay, no, it's just a regular supply, single. It's not a dual supply. And the method is that TTL turns on the opto-isolator, which turns on the Darlington, which brings pin 10 all the way up to 12 volts and ceases oscillation.
Okay. So what you're doing is you want to put a voltage on 1010, is that the idea? Do you have a timing capacitor connected to it?
So a capacitor there, and when you bring 10 all the way up to the rail, then oscillation ceases. If you bring it down, it starts right at zero crossing, gives you a nice burst.
Okay, and from what I'm seeing here, let me just ask you, have you tried shorting the timing capacitor? Does it just oscillate at a very high frequency?
No. Bringing it all the way down, that'll cease oscillation as well? Will that damage your chip?
Yeah, it's real easy to take a FET and just use it to short it out. Actually, if you look at the data sheet has a tone burst generator, a strobe tone burst generator. Although they have an actual IC timing network to control the length of the duration in which it's on, you basically take it to ground. There's also another method which you can use between pin 7 and 8. In essence, what you're doing is you make it, if you open that up, it'll stop oscillating. So, that's another possibility. If you really want to do and bring the rail voltage up if you want to bring it up to the rail voltage and go in on pin 10, you could actually drop the voltage by about 6/10 of a volt on the input of the chip, and then the transistor, the voltage drop across the transistor will be sufficient to deal with it.
Okay. I did try the dropping the voltage. It didn't work. I probably didn't do it right. I'm looking at the data sheet and on pin 10. Is that a MOS device they have there?
It's just a plain old FET. It's not a MOSFET. You can use a transistor. You know, that'll work too. It's just that they wanted the high impedance to make their timing so that it actually makes it, you'll see there's a little pulse next to it.
WB2H, I have a question here. What are you trying to use this device for? Are you trying to send this device out to a radio or something? That's the first question, because I may have an idea for you. I just want to know the output of this audio generator. What are you feeding it to?
It's going to a 10-watt Class D audio amplifier.
You know, if you don't care about the zero crossing, which you can actually control, you could just put a FET in front of the output and just turn the output on and off, you know, pass it or not pass it.
If you short the output, will that damage the chip?
Not necessarily, and you don't have to short it. You were thinking the same thing. You could take the output of that chip and go into a 4066 or a CMOS switch. You go into like the same kind of device that we use in a controller, an audio switch, like a CD4066 or a 4051, one of those type of devices. That's it. Do you need this to be DC coupled? Does he need the thing to be DC coupled to his audio amplifier, or can you capacitively couple it?
You know, it doesn't have a split supply, so there's probably a capacitor in there because his sine wave is probably sitting at half the rail voltage.
Yeah, it's got to be capacitively coupled because there'd be several chips feeding into one amplifier.
Yeah, all you need is a single FET. That'll do the job. It's not like, you don't need a 4066 because you got four of them in there. Oh, unless you want to use a package. I mean, we used to use 4066s, but I think I'm all crossed off when you're doing really good audio stuff. It's not the best in the world. I mean, if you wanted to get fancy, you could use like an OP21, which is a little op amp, but it takes a little bit of smarts. I think you need one resistor. You can use that as literally a volume controller. You can ramp it up and down if you want, or just turn it on and off.
This set here they have on this spec sheet, the 2N4392, that's just a basic N-channel set?
That's a plain old FET. It's got plenty of bandwidth. Nothing fancy. The gate is high impedance, so, you know, anything tittle if you're working with SEMA, it should, you know, put maybe, I guess, 1K resistor on the baseline, on the gate line, and put the, either the drain or the source, one end would go to, say, the output, and the other end would go to wherever you're going.
Okay, but just looking at the spec sheet, they're using a dual supply, minus 15 and plus 15. I'm only using a single supply. Will that affect it? Do you think it'll slow up?
You can always take a clip lead and hook it between pin 10 and ground to, you know, and you're not going to damage anything. And see if it goes away, which I'm sure it will.
Okay, hey, you guys gave me a lot of options, so I've got plenty of work to do. Thank you very, very much for the help. I do appreciate this. N2's at Echo Alpha.
Question here. Did I just hear you say you're running that thing on a single supply? Some of those tone generators must be run on a plus and minus. If you run it on a single supply, you must make sure that whatever the analog reference point is set for half the supply voltage. And then you have a capacitor ground. You have a voltage divider on one of the pins. So are you running this chip on single supply and not on a dual supply?
He said that it's, you know, it's decoupled with the capacitor, so. Well, the output of it, if it's running 10 volts, the center point of the sine wave or the triangle or the square wave will be at about 5.
That's the main reason why it's probably capacitively coupled. Okay, we're going to go back to the space report. So, what, $10 or $20 million each person, two people, rich guys, want to be the first civilians to be near the moon, either a figure eight around the moon or possibly orbiting the moon for a couple of orbits and then coming back to Earth. And that's being planned for possibly the end of 2018, if I understand correctly, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, that's correct, but my guess is probably about $80 million each, somewhere in that neighborhood. Because that's what it cost NASA to pay Russia for every seat that we use to go up on the Soyuz. So that's what that number is up to. And they did say it was going to be close to that number. And according to the report from Elon Musk, plans on doing this multiple times, and he could probably generate 10% of his income from these flights. We'll see. We'll see what happens. The Apollo 8 mission, you know, went up. It didn't have a LEM with it, so that you had three people in a very compact capsule for that whole time. They did do 10 orbits on the moon and come back. Apollo 13 went up. At least they had the LEM to go in with a little bit more room. Turned out it was very uncomfortable for them because of the problem that they had when the oxygen tanks blew up. But this spacecraft has no LEM. It doesn't have a habitat mount module. You're going to have two people in a capsule-style spaceship for 8 or 9 days. So that's going to be pretty tough. NASA's basically doing the same thing when we drop it. They plan on sending two people around the moon. If this comes through, they're still doing a study on that. That might not happen. But they, you know, if they did it would be two people around the moon without a habitat module. So again, it would be close quarters. Very uncomfortable, I think. So, we'll see. Let me just cover a couple of the other topics I wanted to do before I get to you later. There's two other flights planned for 2018. They're going to be one by the European Space Agency, and that will be the solar orbiter. It's going to be spacecraft launched from Cape Canaveral. It'll be launched on an Atlas rocket. European Space Agency is going to have NASA really launch it for them. It's going to go out toward the sun to around a quarter AU, roughly around 20 million miles away from the sun, which is a lot closer than what Mercury is, and it's going to study the sun. And during that same year, now that would be in July, let me drop it. They plan on putting another rocket, NASA does anyway, a lot closer to the sun. The name of that one's going to be called Solar Probe. It's going to be launched on a Delta Heavy. That's three Delta, four rockets, like, strapped together. And that one's going to be sent to the sun as well. But it's going to go in as close as 4 million miles away from the sun. So one will be around 20 million miles out, and this one will be about 4 million. All kinds of exotic protective heating insulation is going to be used in both spacecraft, but especially this one. Two different types of solar panels, one for one that's in close, and it's going to be an elliptical flight, so it'll go in 4 million miles, and then it'll go all the way out to the orbit of Venus. Let me drop it. So when it's far away from the sun, it'll be operating on the solar panels. So the one, when you're in close, 4 million miles away from the sun, those solar panels are going to be facing the sun, but to keep them so they don't melt, there's going to be fluid flowing through it like a refrigeration system to keep the panels from not melting. So that's something to look forward to. A lot of interesting things are going to happen in 2018, or scheduled for 2018. That was the year that Elon Musk planned on sending a Dragon spacecraft unmanned to Mars, but that's been canceled up. That's now probably going to go, the earliest would be 2020. But we have the James Webb Space Telescope that will be launched in October from the European Space Agency down in French Guiana, Kourou, launched on an Ariane 5 rocket. And a couple of the other ones, TESS, will be launched. That's another telescope, space telescope, that will be launched by a Falcon 9 rocket. A lot of things happening during that month, during that year, 2018. One other thing in the news I found interesting was the other day, one of the spacecraft that's in orbit around Mars had to actually make a burn because the orbit was going to intersect the moon Phobos. You know, Mars has two moons, and it would have been on a collision course, so NASA had to move their spacecraft a little bit to avoid that from happening. It's called Mars Maven. That's one of the last ones that NASA's put out there. There's quite a few spacecraft orbiting the planet Mars right now. And it's getting kind of crowded out there. Weird things are starting to happen. So that would have been something if they, you know, if they didn't catch that and their spacecraft wound up hitting Phobos. A couple of other things, but we'll let it go. I know there's two Sundays from now we'll talk about it again. There's another Cygnus cargo launch, not from Wallace Island this time, but from Florida, from Cape Canaveral. It's going to be launched from Launch Complex 41 by the United Launch Alliance on a Nautilus 5 rocket. So Orbital ATK, a private company, is paying for the third time over the last couple of years. Another private company, combination of Boeing and Lockheed, called United Launch Alliance, to launch their rocket. It's a heavy launch vehicle, so instead of putting the roughly 6,000 pounds of supplies on the Cygnus spacecraft, they're able to fit 7,700, almost 8,000 pounds. So that's it. If you have any questions, Dick, we'll turn it back to you. This is WS2M for the space portion of the TechNet.
The solar orbiter you talked about, Paul, I think you said there's going to be two of them. One of them quite a bit inside of the orbit of Mercury, and another one even closer yet. And yes, they're going to require some very fancy reflective shielding so that those spacecrafts don't go to ridiculously high temperatures. And you got to make sure the shielding is aimed in the right direction. If the ship turns around so that the back of the ship is aimed toward the sun, I think it's going to cook real fast. What do you believe, Paul, is the advantage of putting a spacecraft that close to the sun? Is it going to be observing that that layer of ionosphere-like material above the sun that's running at a million degrees? What do they claim is going to be investigated with these very close solar orbiting spacecraft? WS2N, K2RAW.
There's a number of things, of course, star quakes that they have, and but the main one they're looking at is the 11-year cycle, which I found interesting. They really want to study that more. The magnetic field keeps switching. Really would like to get a handle on that and the relationship between that and the solar spots. You think they would have a good idea of what's going on, but there's a lot of missing pieces from what I understand from reading the article. So somehow studying this, with these spacecraft in that close, is going to give them a better handle on what's going on with the 11-year sunspot cycle. Back to you, Dick.
When you see these hydrogen alpha pictures of the sun during the time of a solar prominence, you get billions of cubic miles of gas jumping up in the air, so to speak, at what looks like 10% of the radius of the sun. If one of those occurred, and you've got a very close orbit of this thing, I think, although it's a low probability, it could be hit by one of those solar prominences. Guaranteed, that would be exciting. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I guess they must feel they're far enough away. But I know the one that's 25 million miles away, that's okay. Well, I think Mercury is around, 33 or something. 38 million miles out, but this is going to be roughly 20 million miles away from the sun. But the other one that NASA is launching, the solar probe, is going to be 4 million miles away. That's really in there. But, again, that'll be elliptical. It'll go in tight, come away. As it comes away, it'll transmit a lot of the information and data back to Earth. And I'm going to keep doing these Venus flybys as it does this. So maybe they're going to get some information out of Venus as well. I know there's a Japanese spacecraft that's starting to malfunction now. That's in orbit around Venus. Again, a very highly elliptical orbit. What's the name of that thing? Akkad. I think it's Akkad Zucker. So it's a Japanese word for dream. So, dawn, correction. Yeah, Japanese word for dawn. So, that thing's been in orbit for the last year and a half. Originally, it was supposed to go into orbit in 2010, so 7 years ago, but it didn't work out. It did the main engine failed, wound up going around the orbit around the sun. It took 5 years and came back, and then with the thrusters, used the thrusters to get the spacecraft into orbit. Now they're doing some science.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I timed out. Back to you, Dick.
The current price that NASA pays for an astronaut to ride on the Soyuz to get up to the International Space Station, I think you said is $80 million per astronaut. That's probably the current price. Was that the price in the very beginning, Paul, or has that slowly been going up with inflation? Over to you, K2RAW.
Yeah, I remember it used to be about $40 million $38-40 million. And the private people that used to go up, there's been a total of 9 of them, private citizens that have paid their own way on a Russian spacecraft. Actually, there's been 8 of them. One guy went up twice. But they were always paying around 40, you know, probably a little bit more toward the end. But that's all stopped quite a few years ago. And now NASA kept going up 60, 70, now $80 million. And they just signed a contract. They're using Boeing. Apparently, Boeing is getting money from a lawsuit with Roscosmos, the Russian agency. They were supposed to... They had a deal. See, Russia, Norway, and Boeing had a deal. They were partners on Sea Launch. They call it Sea Launch. It were rockets that used to be launched from the... from the equatorial location from sea. But that whole thing failed after, I don't know, 20 launches or so. Let me drop it. So when it all came apart, it turns out this Russian company owed Boeing a lot of money, $400 million or something in that nature. So they, instead of money, they gave them seats. They gave Boeing seats. We'll allow you to put, you know, 4 or 5 people on board the spacecraft, especially now we're cutting back. Russia said, you know, they're only going to send 2 people up, like the next flight is only going to have 2 people. So now those seats are going to start being filled in with, somehow Boeing made a deal with NASA, and NASA's just signed up 4 or 5 more seats. For probably 2019, 2020, even so, we're going to be having our own people go up with SpaceX and with Boeing Starliner by then, hopefully. It's like an insurance policy. In case something goes wrong with both vehicles and they were unable to comply and meet the contract with NASA, NASA will still have seats on the Soyuz. And the reason they do that, you need to sign up a couple of years in advance. You don't call them up and say, okay, I'm going to send an astronaut, and 1 month later he's on the spacecraft. It takes a couple of years to prepare. It takes a couple of years just to build a spacecraft that's going to be going up to a space station, WS-1.
The two guys that are going to I think it's SpaceX, going to go around the moon at the end of 2018. Have their names been released? And you're estimating that they're probably paying $80 million for that trip. Is that your estimation, Nicole? So do we know who they are? And by the way, once Musk gets this a shuttle to the moon going, is he going to get a whole group of people? In other words, are there going to be 2 of them every 6 months? Or is it just these 2 guys this one time? Over to you, Paul. K2LIW.
Okay, now remember, he's a little optimistic. So, you know, in the long run, he plans on doing 2 per year, 2 flights per year. And, yeah, well, when I get my $80 million, that's my guess. One of the articles was saying that it should cost about as much as what it costs for the Russians. So that's, you know, we know that price. So if that's true, that's what it would be. But he has not released the price. I know there's a big down payment that has been put down. And no, the names have not been released. And they do say that the 2 people know each other very well. So we'll see. Spacecraft that they're going to be launching on is Falcon 9 Heavy. Now, this system hasn't been developed yet. He's launched 28 Falcon 9s already. But this one is going to have 3 Falcon 9s strapped together, bolted together. When it goes off, you know, instead of using solid booster rockets, he's using 2 more Falcon 9 rockets with a total of 27 engines to get off the ground. And then a second stage, you know, always has his one Merlin D engine, and that will push the manned spacecraft all the way to the moon and back. So now this thing hasn't flown yet. It's supposed to fly this summer. Drop first test flight of the Falcon 9 Heavy is supposed to go. I'm going to guess probably July, August, probably the year, earliest, probably August, I'm going to guess. And then he's got another planned mission of the same system later on in the year for the United States military. He has a contract. And that would be the actual first flight. First flight is a test flight, you know, just for Elon Musk to prove that he can do it. And then the next flight at the end of the year would be for the United States military. And then probably another flight or two after that next year. And then at the end of next year, he would be sending these people on a fairly new system from Launch Complex 39A all the way to the moon. Back to you.
Well, you just mentioned 27 individual rocket engines on a launch vehicle. That reminds me of the Russian problem during the rush to the moon way back in the late 60s. They came up with a technique of a large number of rocket engines, and to get them properly balanced when they had a common source fuel supply created an oscillation that gave them a lot of grief. Are these 27 engines all going to be thoroughly independent from each other, or have we gotten so much smarter that we can control that imbalanced oscillation of feed fuel problem? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, he's been very successful so far with the nine engines. You know, Falcon 9 has nine Merlin D engines. So, and he's been upping the thrust capability over the years. Now he's up to, all nine engines, 1.7 million pounds of thrust on one Falcon 9. So, it's going to be roughly a little over 5 million pounds of thrust when these three are launched together, which would be the most powerful rocket on Earth. Well, since the Saturn V, more powerful than the European Space Agency Ariane 5, more powerful than the Russians or the Chinese rockets. So, more powerful than the Delta IV combination, which is our United States NASA heaviest lift vehicle now, the Delta IV Heavy. Three Delta IV rockets put together. I mentioned that earlier. That's going to be one of the ones that are going to launch the solar probe to the sun. So, 27 Merlin D engines. Each one is called a Merlin D. Manufactured hundreds of these things so far, and some of them have gone into the drink, but eight of them have been recovered, eight boosters. So he's going to eventually save these engines and relight them. In fact, one of those flights is going to be coming up for the first time this year as well, a reflight of one of the boosters. But in time it out, WS2N.
27 Merlin D engines. What's that total amount of thrust, Paul? K2RIW.
Yeah, I believe it's 5.2 million. So it's, each one now is 1.7 million. So it's, you know, three times that number. So, yeah, that's what it is. And his new launch pad that he built, that he launched the last rocket from, the cargo vehicle that's now attached to the space station, was launched from Launch Complex 39A, and that has a brand new lifter, one that they had at Launch Complex 40 that blew up, really took out that lifting mechanism, and that was only, a toy compared to this thing. This mechanism that can lift three Falcon 9 rockets. They said 1.5 million pounds, a little bit more than that. So he's really got quite a bit riding on this Falcon 9 Heavy. But yeah, 27 engines, 9 on each one. Back to you there.
What makes the requirement for such a high amount of thrust? In the case of Apollo 11, you were lifting the command module, the service module, and the lunar module. Hell of a lot of stuff. These guys are not going to be doing any landing. All they need is a service module and the command module. Yeah, the command module is bigger than the Apollo 11 command module. I'm wondering why so darn much thrust is required just to loop around the moon, so to speak. Although, maybe you need extra rocket power if you're going to go into lunar orbit and then come back out of lunar orbit. Also, I'm wondering, do these volunteer civilian astronauts, civilians, who know each other very well, I presume they're both male. If they know each other very well, and one is male and one is female, does that mean somebody wants to top the mile high club by going to the quarter million mile high club? It's a little bit of a joke. Over to you, Paul, K2IW.
Yeah, I was thinking, I hope they're married, because, they did psychology tests early on in the space program, and one of the reasons they thought it would be a good idea is to have three people go to the moon all that time in a spacecraft, because when there's two people, two males in particular, they're going to start to get on each other's nerves. But with a third one there, it's like somebody to break the boat, If two people are complaining about something, the third person tends to break the boat. And it was actually, they actually did psychology tests early on. I don't know how much validity there is to it, but if that's true, there's NASA plans on only sending two again around the moon, and in the Orion spacecraft, at least there's a lot more room in that thing, and then two on Dragon. So, we're going to find out if that psychology test has any truth to it. Back to you, Dick.
So, run this by again, Paul. The two people that are going up around this lunar orbit on the end of 2018, do we think they're both male, or is there one male, one female? Go ahead.
Oh, I don't know. That's why I'm saying I was wondering about that. But my guess is probably two male, and each one with plenty of money.
Yeah, these billionaires, and there's a few of them these days, don't know what to do with their money. And if they only knew what it's like to be an astronaut in space, in a small, cramped sardine can for like a week at a time, week and a half, I'm guessing, the total mission. And each time you have to do a process that you and I would call going into the bathroom, and there's no private room you can go into in that spacecraft. So it's got to be at least uncomfortable. How are you, Paul, K2IW?
Yeah, one of the Gemini missions, they wanted to test out if they could make 14 days long duration mission. Borman and Lowell were on there, and they got along the whole time, so worked out good. But they were in a tight vehicle. Gemini was very, very small. If you want to stretch out your whole body, in that spacecraft, Push your feet all the way out and straighten out your back at the whole day. You couldn't do it. You could straighten out your legs at one time, and then you could straighten out your back and neck, one or the other, but not both. So that was tight quarters, but they got along for 2 weeks in this thing. But I thought they were going to kill each other by the time they came out, but it worked out, But these are trained astronauts. This is what they do. They did a lot of training years before. They knew what they were going to be doing. I can't imagine these two people going up for an 8-day trip around the moon. I wonder if they're going to be thinking about, I don't know if this was such a good idea. This is the opposite of a good idea as they're going. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of that 14-day Gemini mission, I think you and I can speculate that those astronauts, the two of them, for 14 days, had 14 days without taking a shower. Am I correct on that one, Olga?
Yeah, and nowadays they do the same thing. They all have these wipes and things, grown-up baby wipes. But it's a good trivia question. Was there ever a shower installed in a spacecraft? And which one was it? If you care to answer that, I can give you the answer if you like to.
Yeah, we're essentially out of time, but I think Skylab had sort of a shower installed. Is that true, Ripple?
I knew you would get it. Yes, they did. And it was like this big shower curtain that was like a circular thing. I'm going at. But there's pictures of that. Very good, Dick. We're to the end. Yeah, I see the clock. K2RA WWS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
And that was space report number 241. This was TechNet number 1641. We intend to be back next week. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. And back to you for any final comments, Paul. K2RA W clear.
No further comments. Just we'll see you next week. No big launch going this week. Cygnus 2 Sundays from now. And then we'll talk about the Chinese flights coming up in a month or two. Activating their space station temporarily. A lot of things to talk about. We'll be back. WS2N will be clear. Have a good night, Dick.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. WQVL repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system.
N2EO, N2MB Mobile.
N2MB, 60% you copy?
I'm going to switch to 5-2, N2MB Mobile.
That's a 5-2, so you have a chance to change yet.
N2MB, K6DPC, I didn't have a chance to change yet. Go back to 5-2.
net tonight at 8:30 W2VL repeater system. Repeater.
N2MB, K6GPC. Meet me on 5-2. On 5-2, K6GPC, N2SY.
Friendly voice. How are you doing this morning?
Doing okay. Glad that it's a little bit warmer than it was yesterday. A tad, but I think it's supposed to warm up during the course of the day.
We definitely have bipolar weather, that's for sure. So nice and warm. I guess it was, I don't know, 4 or 5 days ago. And then we suddenly got plunged back into winter. And, yeah, got some potential good news here. We've got a feral cat rescue willing to take the last three in the parking lot. So, with some luck, we had it all lined up before the winter, and then some bad things happened. So hopefully, we'll get it done, and the three will be out of the lot, and they'll be at a new home. Go ahead.
The problem that we have is that we have two of them in the house now. I don't believe would have any problem being indoor cats. And, again, I live on a main street, so there's no way that having gone through everything that they're going out. Excuse me. One of them was already taken care of and his injuries were all fixed. The other one will have this week. But one of the questions I was going to ask you, and I know we're probably boring people with the conversation, but we have an appointment, I think, on Friday with the town to take care of one of the feral cats that will be an outside feral cat. You know, it's not like you can say to the cat, okay, Friday morning you have your appointment, and let's get you into the cat's cage now. You know, it's just, I'm not sure exactly how we do it. You know, what happens if we catch the cat on Thursday? You can't take it out of the trap. So I'm not sure what we do with that.
Roger, WA6ABC. So it's a common problem. And some cats are not catchable very well with your have-a-heart trap. The older ones are used to seeing it and won't respond to it. In fact, that's the issue we had, one of the issues we have at the lot. We're actually having somebody who's a specialist come in who uses what's called a drop trap. And you put the food in the middle of this thing, and basically you pull a lever and it comes down on the cat, and then you have to get the cat into these transfer cages. If you look up drop trap, you'll see the mechanism. It's a very much more difficult method, but more likely to catch the animal on a time schedule. The other thing you have to be willing to do is have a place where the cats can go in the interim. Like right now, we're probably going to be looking at Friday night, and I'm going to have to probably find a location.